Good morning. Today we are on the third Sunday of Great Lent, when we commemorate the Holy Cross. And so what I thought I would do this morning would be to talk a little bit about the cross, its significance, and some of the Old Testament types and prophecies about the cross that show up in our readings and in our hymnography and all. In the first place, the cross was originally prefigured even in the Garden of Eden. There is a reference in Revelation chapter 13 where it says that the Lamb of God, was slain from the foundation of the world, which seems odd, but that Christ had been slain from the foundation of the world. If Christ had been slain from the foundation of the earth, then also the Holy Cross had to exist from the foundations of the earth as well. And in point of fact, that's what we find in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 9. He says, in the middle of the garden were the tree of life and the tree of learning the knowledge of good and evil. And the tree of life then is one of the common designations for the Holy Cross that we find in our hymnology. So there it is at the very beginning. The tree of life in the center of paradise becomes then the symbol for the cross. Now, that gets picked up a lot of ways. In point of fact, in the altar itself, this is the reason why there is always a large cross immediately behind the altar in every Orthodox church. It's because the altar area represents paradise among all the other things that it represents, but it also represents paradise in the Garden of Eden. And so that's why then, when you look at Eden, you expect to see the tree of life standing in the middle of the garden, and in point of fact, it is. That's the cross right behind the altar. And again, it's why I'm glad that we have the curtain up here now as well, because today, being in tone 7, we're going to sing the tone 7 resurrectional troparion, which says, in part, the flaming sword no longer guards the gates of paradise. And that's what the curtain symbolizes. So whenever we begin a service to the Lord, we open the curtain because the flaming sword of the cherubim has been taken away. We now have access to paradise, to the Garden of Eden, access to heaven that we did not have since the time that Adam and Eve fell and they were expelled from the garden. And so that's why we always open the curtain at the beginning of the services. We see paradise, we have access, and we see the tree of life standing in the middle of the garden. The fact that the tree of life stands in the very center of the garden is significant. It stands in the middle of the garden because it is, in fact, an axis mundi. It's the axis of the world. It is the point from which all of creation then spreads out in every direction. You may remember that the Garden of Eden had four rivers that flows out from it, that waters the face of the whole earth. And so the image is of the tree of life standing in the center, the four rivers going out like a cross from it, watering the four cardinal directions of the earth, north, east, south, and west. So that puts the tree of life right in the center of the created world, which means it's the still point, it's the origin, omphalos kosmou, as they say in Greek, the navel of the world, as you were. That's the point where everything starts. And in a lot of medieval maps, even, you will see maps of the world. They always put Jerusalem and Golgotha right at the center of the map. Because even in medieval thought, the cross of Christ, Golgotha, was still the center of the world from which everything else originates and radiates out. So to have an axis mundi, you think of it like, for those of us old enough to remember vinyl records, it's the pin in the center that the record goes around. It stands perfectly still while the rest of the record spins around it. Similarly, the cross of Christ stands still in the center of the world while the entire world goes around it. In fact, the Carthusian Benedictine order, which was a medieval order of contemplative monks, their motto was Stat Crucis Volvitur Orbis. The cross stands still while the world revolves. And that was it. Okay, so the cross is at the center. What an axis mundi also does, though, is that it unites different realms. And so the point of origin of this world unites it to the other worlds as well. So, for example, it unites heaven and earth. And if we think about Golgotha, which becomes the Christian symbol, the reincarnation of the tree of the tree of life in paradise, that it's what? The cross is planted down in the earth, so it's planted in the underworld. It stands upright in this world, but Christ is lifted up on it, and so it points to heaven as well. So the cross of Christ unites heaven and earth and the underworld as well. All of them come together, and so it becomes the place where we go, where we can access heaven as well. And that's the significance of an Axis Mundi. All right? There are... it's also... do we understand that? You see, so you know, if you're looking for access to heaven, and this is very Christian, St. Paul talks about this, we approach heaven, we approach God through whom? Through Jesus Christ and Him crucified. That's how we approach heaven, all right? Always through the sacrifice of Christ. In fact, I'll just go off on a little tangent here. There's this peculiar story in the Old Testament. Moses has set up the tabernacle in the wilderness, and he's built the ark, and they've got, you know, the whole tent set up there. And two sons of Aaron, Phinehas and who's the other one? I forget, Hophni and Phinehas, I think. They said they offered strange fire before the Lord, and God struck them dead. They said, what the hell is this? You know, here they are. They just get the directions. Here's young guys. They just get the new set of instructions. It's just been given on Mount Sinai. They're brand new at this job. They're still learning the ropes, as it were. And they somehow mess up and offer strange fire before the Lord, and God strikes them dead for this. Okay, what's going on? All right. What they were doing was they were putting... You remember the tabernacle in the wilderness. It had the veil over the Holy of Holies. The ark is behind the veil. In the center of the tent was the altar of incense. Okay? And morning and evening, they offered incense before the Lord. Okay. The altar of incense needs coals on it that you can put the incense on. Right? Okay. That was the fire that was being talked about. They put the wrong coals on the altar. Well, duh. Okay, where are you supposed to get the right coals to put on the altar of incense? The right coals came from the altar outside the tent, which was the altar of sacrifice, where they burnt the whole burnt offerings. Those were burned in front, not inside the tent, but in front of the tent, outside. And it was, the directions were clear. You were to take the coals from the altar of sacrifice in and put that on the altar of praise, and then offer the incense on it. Which, the significance of it is this: they were struck dead because you only approach God through sacrifice. We only approach God through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Because Phinehas and Hophni did not go through sacrifice to approach God, they messed up the imagery. And it made it more difficult for Christians to understand that we eventually, and everyone, that we eventually approach Christ only through sacrifice. And for us, that's the sacrifice of the cross of Christ. So we always approach Christ, God through the cross of Jesus Christ. Capiche? Does this make sense? You see how even in the Old Testament, when they don't get the imagery right, there's you know, significant damage that can be done. And you can lose your life. Okay. As in this story. But the Tree of Paradise, the Axis Mundi, was also an example of what was a world tree. And maybe if you know anything about Norse mythology, you know that there's the Yggdrasil, I think it was an ash tree. There's this huge tree that grew right in the middle of the earth and sort of supported everything else. Well, there are a lot of cultures around the world that all have world trees. And in point of fact, I found one in the book of in the prophet Ezekiel. He's in Ezekiel chapter 31. He makes reference to it. He likens, I think, the king of Assyria to a world tree. It's in Ezekiel, Ezekiel 31. So in the third, let's see. The word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, go say to Pharaoh the king of Egypt and to his multitude, to whom do you liken yourself in your high position? Behold, Assyria was a cypress in Lebanon. So here's the description. The king of Assyria is being likened to the world tree, and you'll see what it is. He was beautiful in offshoots and high in greatness. His rule came to be among the clouds. So you have a tree that's so big that its branches go up to the clouds. All right, this is the world tree. It connects earth and heaven, you see? Water nurtured him, and the depths made him grow tall. The depths led her rivers around his trees and sent forth her system into all the trees of the plain. For this reason, his greatness was exalted above all the trees of the plain, and his branches were enlarged because of the abundance of the water. All the birds of the heavens made their nests in his offshoots, and under his branches all the wild animals of the plains brought forth their young, and all the multitudes of the nations dwelt under his shadow. Thus he was beautiful in his high position because of the multitude of his branches, for his roots were in much water. There were no such cypresses in the paradise of God, and there were no pine trees displaying offshoots like these. Silver firs did not have branches like this. No tree in the paradise of God was like him in beauty because of the multitude of his branches, and all the trees of God's paradise of splendor were jealous of him. Wow, that's a pretty good tree, you know? So this is an example of it. There, you see the wild animals are there, the birds of the air have their habitation in his branches. So wherever the world tree is, that establishes what? Order and peace, and everybody, you know, all the animals are multiplying, so there's fecundity and there's flourishing and there's fruitfulness, and the world is going on like it's supposed to, because when you're at the world tree, you have heaven and earth connected, and so grace and goodness and all spread out in all directions. All right? That's what you get. So this is an example in Ezekiel, and if you flip over a few pages into the book of Daniel, we find that in Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream about the world tree, and this is in Daniel chapter 2. The description is a little less extensive, but I'll give it to you. Chapter 2 and verses 10 through 12, basically. That's just about the dream. Let's see, here it is. Let the king tell his servants. That's the description. It's Daniel chapter 4. Here I'm in Daniel chapter 2, trying to get the vision of the great, you know, image with the head of gold and the shoulders of silver and all turned into the world tree, and it's just not working for me. No wonder I'm in the wrong chapter. Here he is. So Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. I was on my bed and I looked, and behold, in the midst of the earth there was a very tall tree. The tree was large and strong. Its height reached to heaven and its extent to the ends of the earth. Its leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in it there was food for all. The wild animals lived beneath it. All the birds of heaven dwelt in its branches. All flesh were fed from it. Okay? So, that's it. Eventually, a watcher, an angel, comes down and cuts down the world tree, and chaos and disorder ensue. So that's what you have. Wherever the world tree is healthy and whole, everything is good. Similarly, though, what the significance for us as Christians, then, is that the cross of Christ functions in the same way. It's why we put it in the middle of the church, so that when the cross of Christ is central in the church, then it extends order, blessing, peace, goodness, fruitfulness out to the four corners of the earth. And in point of fact, the practice of venerating the cross, Stavroproskynesis, the veneration of the cross, is an ancient practice. In the year 614, the Persians under Khosrowes Parviz, the Persian king, captured the city of Jerusalem. They sold 90,000 Christians to the Jews as slaves in those days, and they carried off the relic of the true cross back to the Persian fire temple at the capital in Ctesiphon in Persia. The emperor Heraclius went to Persia, destroyed the fire temple, and retrieved the Holy Cross and brought it back to Jerusalem. This is what we celebrate on September the 14th. The emperor brought the Holy Cross back and found that he could not pass through the gates of the city of Jerusalem, and because he came back in royal procession. And finally, one of the monks there said, you know, listen, your majesty, that is not the way that Christ entered the city of Jerusalem, dressed in finery and all. That's not the way he carried his cross, and that might have something to do with it. So the emperor said, he's got a point. So he took off all of his imperial raiment, and he dressed himself in a simple garment, and with that he was able to take the relic of the true cross into the city and restore it to the church. So it was restored about the year of 631, and they brought it back in, and on September the 14th, the Patriarch of Jerusalem held a celebration in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and he showed the people the relic of the cross that it was back. It's a very large relic. I don't know how it's shaped, but he held up the relic of the cross, and everybody in the church fell down on their knees and began crying, Lord, have mercy. And to this, as a result of that, from that historical event in 631, every year on the Feast of the Exaltation of the Cross, in cathedrals where the bishop is, bishops and abbots are the only ones who are allowed to do this, but the bishop will do the rite of the elevation of the cross, where he takes the Holy Cross and he will elevate it very slowly, very high up, very low down, and make the sign of the cross. And he'll do that in all four directions while he's standing on the cathedral box in the center of the church. And the choir has beautiful arrangements of like hundredfold Lord have mercies that they sing during this service. I think, in fact, Sharon, our choir director, found one. I said, oh, you've got music for this. I haven't heard this in years and years. But the bishop will do this. And what is he doing? He's blessing the four quarters of the earth with the Holy Cross, because the cross had been reestablished at the center of the universe, back where it belonged, so that order and harmony and fruitfulness could be restored. Okay? And so in commemoration of that, like I say, September the 14th is that particular commemoration, but because we're getting close to observing the passion and the death, the crucifixion of Christ, the Holy Church puts the cross out for us in the center of, in the middle of Great Lent, so that we know what's coming, and it gives us time to meditate upon the passion, the cross of Christ. Yes, sir?
Does that relic still exist?
The relics of the Holy Cross do still exist. I don't know what they have in Jerusalem. The largest relic of the true cross outside of Jerusalem, I actually saw. It's in Cerro Potamu Monastery on Mount Athos. They have a reliquary. It's about, I don't know, 8 by 10, I think the relic of the cross is about 8 by 10 inches. And it's covered with a, you know, a gold riza, a gold cover that's, you know, revealed in the shape of a cross, but there's a solid piece of wood behind it. And in the monasteries of Mount Athos, before Vespers every day, they bring out the relics for the veneration of the faithful. And I had heard this, and sure enough, I got to see this beautiful reliquaries encrusted with jewels and all that people have donated over the ages and all, and they would bring that out for our veneration. So I got to see that three times, you know, while I was there. There are relics of the True Cross available in this country as well. I can't tell you who's got one off the top of my head, but I have seen them. Yeah. Yes, Richard?
Yeah, the Dormition, don't they have a sliver of the cross?
I don't know that they have a sliver of the cross at Holy Dormition or not.
Again, in my old age, not as sharp as they used to be, but I thought they had a sliver there.
Maybe they do. If they did, I missed it, because I'm a great lover of relics, and I'm usually pretty good at, you know, at a quick catalog of whatever anybody's got.
They have a whole bunch of,
yeah, they've got the big box full of them there.
Maybe,
and I've just not paid good attention. Yeah, but they're around. They're around, usually very small. So at any rate, to go back to the scriptures then. There's the image of, in Genesis chapter 48, you may remember Jacob was going to bless his grandsons, Benjamin and Ephraim. And you know, he goes out and his father puts, I think Judah puts his, Benjamin puts his, let me get the name straight, because I'm going to mess them up. So his dad brings them and puts the youngest on the left side and the eldest on the right side of Grandpa Jacob so that he can bless the eldest with his, with the greater blessing. And old Jacob, even though he's blind at this point, knows which kid is which, and he crosses his hands this way and bestows the blessing with his right hand on the younger son. And the story goes like this. So Joseph took both of them, Joseph, Ephraim with his right hand towards Israel's left and Manasseh with his left hand towards Israel's right hand, brought them near him. So Israel, or Jacob, stretched out his right hand, laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly. For Manasseh was the firstborn. All right. Now when Joseph, and he pronounces the blessing. When Joseph saw his father put his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. So Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." But the father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he shall be exalted. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations." All right. So, even there at the beginning, the significance of a blessing done in the form of a cross. At the Passover, in Exodus chapter 12, it says that the Jews were to take a lamb and they were to slay it, and that they were to take the blood of the lamb and they were to mark the lintel above the door and the two doorposts, and that way the angel of death would know to pass over that house and not to kill the inhabitants that were inside. According to Prophet Ezekiel, in chapter 9, verse 6 of Ezekiel, he mentions that the mark that was made was a tau, which is a cross shape, a T, which is the way that in Hebrew, the Hebrew letter T was made before they went to using what's now modern Hebrew lettering. And so the Jews, when they were saved from the angel of death in Egypt, had marked a cross on the lintel and on the doorposts of their houses with the blood of what? The Passover lamb. Okay, so the blood of Christ, the cross there, you see the blood of the lamb go together in the imagery as well. When Moses divides the Red Sea after the people are let go, and they're down at the Red Sea and Pharaoh's pursuing them, this is in Exodus chapter 14, it said God told him to stretch out his hands, and Moses stretched out his hands holding the rod of Aaron in his hands, and he stretched out his hands. The fathers tell us he stretched his hand. First, the gesture he made was this way, to split the sea. So a vertical gesture to split the sea in two, and then like this to bring the waters back together was a horizontal gesture. So even in the separation of the Red Sea and its returning to cover Pharaoh's army was in fact Moses had transcribed a cross with his hands to do so. Now, I'll get to that. That's the next story. Okay. Two stories ahead of me. All right. But so the dividing of the Red Sea then was done in the shape of a cross. And again, the division of the Red Sea, the passing through the water, is, of course, one of the great images of baptism that we have. And, of course, the drowning of Pharaoh's army is the drowning of sin and death in the waters of baptism. So that's why we recite that story on Great and Holy Saturday, at the time when the early Christians baptized everybody. The next story in order comes in chapter 15, where the sixth stop that the Jews made out in the wilderness, they came to the water of Marah, and they couldn't drink the water of Marah because they were bitter. Actually, the word Marah in Hebrew means bitter. That's why it's called the place. Okay. So Moses, and so the people complained to Moses, because they're always complaining to Moses, right? And they said, "What are we going to drink because the water's bitter?" So God showed Moses the wood of a certain tree, and he threw the wood of the tree into the water, and the waters were made sweet, and the people were able to drink. Okay, it's an imitation of this then, is the reason why when the priest blesses the holy water on Theophany and in the baptismal font, we take the wood of the cross and we plunge it into the water and trace the sign of the cross with the very cross itself in the font and in the holy water to sanctify it. Because that's what makes the waters sweet and fills them with grace. Okay? And then the image, two chapters later in 17 of Exodus, Aaron's point, Amalek, the king, comes out to fight with Israel because they're getting close to Amalek's territory. And so Amalek leads his army out to fight against the Jews, and Moses goes up on top of the hill to oversee the battle. And he held out his hands like this, and so long as he held out his hands, Israel was victorious over Amalek, but Moses got tired of holding his arms up, which you try it sometimes, see how long you last. And when his arms flagged down, then Amalek, the battle turned, and Amalek was taking the field. So Aaron and Joshua brought a stone and for Moses to sit down on, and they stood there holding his arms, one on each side, all day long until Amalek was defeated. So long as Moses maintained the shape of a cross, he was victorious. And when his arms flagged, then they were not. And so to pray with your arms out in the form of a cross is actually an ancient Christian practice. And there are accounts of some of the monks in the desert, the Desert Fathers, who would do this in the early centuries. I forget, there was a very famous monk who must have had shoulders of iron, because it said he would stand with his back to the setting sun, and he would greet the rising sun the next morning with his arms still held out. So he would stand all night in prayer like this to God, which is pretty spectacular. But there it is. So Moses traces the cross in his body and defeats Amalek. Another great example of it is the bronze serpent, which is in Numbers chapter 21. Once again, the children of Israel are murmuring against Moses, and against God, and God gets tired of it. This is a tale with this. Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us in this desert? There's no bread, there is water. Our soul is weary with this worthless bread. We're sick and tired of the manna that God gave us. All right? That's what they're saying. So the Lord sent venomous serpents among the people and bit the people, and many of the children of Israel died. Okay, you ingrates. Then the people came to Moses and said, "We sinned, we spoke against the Lord and against you. Therefore, pray the Lord to take the serpents from us." So the Lord said to Moses, "Make a serpent for yourself and put it on a signal pole. And it shall be, if a serpent is about to bite someone, if a serpent should bite someone and the one bitten looks at it, he shall live." So he makes this bronze snake. He puts it on a signal pole, which is shaped like a cross. So he hangs this bronze serpent on there and sets it up, because it's a reminder of the sin of the people. And so as long as the people, when they remember this and they look at the serpent and they remember the sin that they blasphemed against God, and by looking upon it and recalling their sin, then God healed them. Similarly for us, because Christ himself in John's gospel used the bronze serpent as a symbol of himself. He says, "Even as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so shall the Son of Man be lifted up," in the same way. So we know it's a symbol of Christ in his crucifixion. And when we look at Christ crucified, we also should see our own sins, because it is our sins that put him there. And that's what we need to acknowledge. Okay? So that's what we see when we see Christ crucified. Also, Joshua, in the book of Joshua, when he's fighting against the city of Ai in the Promised Land, remembered what Moses had done in defeating Amalek. And in Joshua chapter 8 and verse 26, it says that at that battle, Joshua also held out his hands he had a spear in one hand, but he held his arms out. And so long as he held his arms out, the children of Israel were victorious, and they defeated the city of Ai and were able to be victorious there. For ourselves. So there's a number of Old Testament types of the Holy Cross for us. How much time do I have?
2-3 minutes.
Okay. Then I'll say just a few other things about the cross. Then it is one of the sign of the cross is one of the strongest prayers that we have. People sometimes just want to make the cross kind of sloppily and whatnot, or thoughtlessly. I encourage you not to do that. I always remember Vladika Job, whenever he would serve. He always made the sign of the cross so beautifully and very, very deliberately. And it struck me every time I saw him that he did that, and it convicted me not to try to make the cross sloppily. It's a very great protection. The demons are more afraid of the cross than of almost anything else, and they can be put to flight. If you're beset by temptations, if you're beset by worries or trials, the sign of the cross, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, is a very, very powerful prayer. Even if you don't say words, but if you simply make the sign of the cross, this can be a great help. St. Simeon, I won't quote St. Simeon, the new theologian, but I'll also recommend this to you because it's actually come up a couple of times this Lent with some people. And that is that holding on to the cross can also be a very powerful thing because it is an axis mundi, because it is that which stands at the center of the world and which establishes order and connection with heaven. We find that if we have chaos and disorder or disruption in our own lives, going to the cross can be very powerful in reestablishing peace and order, reducing anxiety and chaos in your life. So that if you find yourself all upset for whatever reason, I encourage you to go to the cross. And I've even encouraged people to do this. Go to a Christian bookshop or a Catholic bookshop or something, or I think everything is on eBay or from Amazon. But find yourself a little cross. Maybe not one as big as this. This is maybe a little large, what I wear. But something a couple of inches, maybe. What you want is a cross, not the little tiny gold cross that, you know, especially women wear very small crosses. It's just not big enough. I mean, you go to grab it and there's hardly anything there. I want you to find a cross that's big enough that when you hold on to it, you know you're holding something. That's the point. However big that is for you, but it's probably a couple of inches. Find something in wood, find something in stone, find something in metal. It doesn't much matter. But if you get yourself a little cross that you can hold on to, especially if you know if you're going through tough times or you're not well or you're dealing with sick relatives or your job's in question or just the chaos of the world gets to be too much, if you grab hold of that cross and just hold on to it, even when you say your prayers, it can have a remarkably calming and centering effect on you. And it can help to restore order in an agitated soul. And I've mentioned this several times in sermons here. I wanted to make sure that I said it to at least a few people this year, because every so often someone will come and say, look, Father, I still have the cross, and will pull it out of their pocket, a little one that they carry with them. Or a woman will say, look, I keep it here in my purse with me all the time. But something like that, that you can physically hold on to, so like I say, you know, this is sort of the comfort where you can grab it, can be very, very powerful. And because, like I say, the cross is the axis mundi. It's the symbol of our salvation. It is the Christian symbol of power. And because of its role, and because it is the tree of life in the center of paradise, it can help to restore order and peace and harmony to your heart when you're upset. So I commend the practice to you. And even if you don't want to do that, if you have a cross at home and you find yourself upset, you go stand in front of your icons, look at the cross of Christ, and reconnect with that. And see if it doesn't help you. All right? So there's my commendation to you this morning. Thanks too much.